Welcome to episode 83 of the Draft Lab Podcast. I'm your fabulous host, Josh Phillips, aka J2S Josh. I'm once again joined by all-time 17 Lands Trophy leader, Chris Palmiotti, aka Floridamon. I am required to print a slight retraction from last week. Apparently, Alligator Andy was not the villain in Chris's adventure, but an ally as they sought to take down the evil Crocodile Carl. How's it going today, Chris?
I can't believe I messed that up, dude. Alligator Andy is my boy.
We get this question all the time, so we might as well pop off an episode on it. Today, we're going to be discussing whether or not you should be playing around something.
I thought we were going to be discussing whether being rank 137 15 days before the season ends was good enough. Because that's another question I get all the time. And I'm sick of it. I don't know if you're ranked 87 on the seventh day of the season, if that's good enough. I don't know. And I don't know if you're ranked 237 with 3 hours to go, if that's good enough. I don't know. No one knows.
What we're actually talking about is whether or not you should be playing around something. The biggest rule is that if you can't possibly beat something, you don't ever play around it. Let's say you have the option to go for lethal, but you would get blown out by removal. But if they had that removal to remove your only flying blocker and you would die anyway the next turn, you just go for it. There are lots of times when make them have it is correct, but this is the almost always do it scenario. Don't play scared when you can figure out that doesn't matter either way.
Yeah, and like conversely, if the only way you could lose is playing around one or two cards in the set, you should probably play around them.
One of the biggest things to play around is sweepers. First up, on the can you beat it subject, holding back a random 2-2 is probably not going to make the difference against a Sunfall if they're still high in life. Holding back Natali when you can still push lethal the next turn will make a difference. Those are extremes, but I think you get the point. You have to evaluate whether or not it's worth it to play around it. Oftentimes, it's not unlimited unless there's an uncommon one to worry about, unless they're playing in a way that makes you suspicious that they do have one. A great example is in Mom. Your opponent has done very little, and for some reason they chose not to flip an incubator when it was basically free to do so. They could have made a mistake, they could have been afraid of not holding up a counter protection spell, or they could be setting you up for Sunfall. You have to take in and process the information as you're provided with it. Did they make some suspicious chump blocks at a high life total? Maybe you don't dump your hand. Have they not done much besides playing only legendary creatures? Consider that Invasion of Fiora as an option. There are lots of important points of information you should be gathering along the way.
Yeah, they're getting sneaky with these raft designs, though, because it's like, oh, I can make a million mites and also raft the board. Or, oh, I get to make an 8-8 and raft the board. I can play in a way where it's so much harder for my opponent to see that I'm about to raft them. Which makes it like a bit like what Josh was saying, paying attention to the very small details throughout the turns. Old school rafts that are just two-sided rafts, that's it. At sorcery speed or whatever, it's very easy to see those coming. When they could still add to the board while rafting the board, it becomes much harder to detect. So keep your radars on.
Or the damage-based one. Sometimes you're like, oh, they didn't play a 2-drop, but they played something with 3 toughness. Maybe they have the 2-damage pyroclasm spell.
Right, right. Luckily, the ones that you see most common in this set, specifically Mom, is Sunfall and Fiora. And Fiora is one of those things that's not that easy to really turn it around after you cast it sometimes, unless there's an inherent difference in legendary creatures on the battlefield.
Another thing to think about is counter spells. They are an interesting thing because every format is going to provide you with different challenges. This is a constructed example, but I thought it was applicable to playing around them. I was playing Beltran Historic. It was late in the game, and I was positive my opponent saw a counter spell in hand. I used Indomitable Creativity, knowing that I had 0 Belchers left in my deck, targeting a treasure that I actually needed to go off that turn. If they let it resolve, I get nothing, and I can't ritual into killing them with Belcher. If I try to hold priority so I can still sack the treasure, they know to let it resolve. If they let it resolve and I do have a Belcher left in my deck, they die. So my read on their counterspell put them in the position that they had to make a read on what I was doing. They assumed that I wouldn't be making that play unless it was a winning play, so they countered the creativity and I ended up winning instead.
Very nice, sir.
You're probably asking, why is this relevant to Limited? Did Josh just want to tell a sick bluff story? Well,
I think so. That's what I'm thinking.
It's because I presented a threat that they felt they had to deal with while hiding the real threat. It probably won't get that complicated in draft, but you do want to try to put yourself in their position and think through the outcomes. You want to kind of force them to do something.
I was playing on stream earlier today, and there was a situation where my opponent had, it was early in the game, so there was like no creatures in the graveyard. My opponent was playing blue-black, and they had 2 blue and a black up, and I was faced with playing a creature or playing a Marauding Dreadship. And usually I like to play the play pattern of, oh, I'll play Marauding Dreadship after I have a creature on the board so I can haste it out, right? But in that situation, it's kind of a no-brainer to play the Marauding Dreadship because A, it gets around Assimilate Essence, it gets around a Vanquish the Weak, and there's no really good card draw for 3 mana in this format other than Unseal for blue-black. And so if you know you can strand your opponent's mana for one of the early turns where it's kind of critical to do something productive, like add to the board, kill something, do something, it becomes so much better. That's like playing around a counterspell in a way where even if you don't have a Marauding Dreadship, if you're just looking at like a 2-drop versus Gift of Completion, the 2-drop counterspell in this format doesn't hit enchantments. You'd want to lead with a Gift of Completion in that instance. It also plays around the removal, right? There's these situations where if you think your opponent has a counterspell and you can play around it, you should definitely do that. There's also these other situations where it's like, I'm going to have to get a counter out of their hand at some point. They're in a position where they never have to really tap out. In that case, you have to recognize that sooner rather than later, and you just have to run your second best card into their counterspell in a lot of instances. You're not going to win the game by hoping they tap out when they already are ahead, or they probably have a deck set up where they could play a counterspell. If you don't make them cast it, they could like draw cards and stuff. And so it very much so varies in terms of what's on the battlefield, how much mana they have access to, are they ahead on the board or not, in terms of like how you have to approach, quote unquote, playing around a counterspell.
The example I was going to talk about is, let's say it's turn 3, you're on the play, opponent has a blue and a random other mana up, and you have the choice between Eyes of Gataxias or Preening Champion.
Right. Play the Eyes, please. If they have Negate, they get you.
If they have priority and did nothing, then you can consider they might have a Land Cycler. If they don't have priority, it's possible they might have kept a slow hand. There are a ton of things to consider there, but the reason I brought up those two specific cards is, of course, Negate versus Assimilate Essence. At this point in the format, in most cases, I would assume they're playing Assimilate Essence over Negate, which leans more towards playing Eyes.
With that said, if you don't have anything else to do on turn 3 and you're facing best of 1, they happen to have 2 mana up, I think you should kind of always run your creature out in that instance, right? I don't think it's correct in most instances to auto-default to playing around a counterspell, but I think if you can play around it meaningfully well without really jeopardizing your tempo, spending your mana, I think you should do that. Would you agree with that?
You also have to consider the rest of your curve. Like, can you flip the ice token next turn while holding up your own counterspell? There's just so many things going into those decisions, and I think that's one of the things that I really love about Magic. Like, a lot of the time, you see quote-unquote good Magic players following their gut in their decisions, but it's not really following their gut so much as they've developed the ability to process all of that information without even thinking about it.
Yeah, one of the most frustrating things as someone who is pretty good at reading what's going on their opponent is when my gut says something and I'm like, oh, I should just go for it anyway. And I'm like right 80% of the time. I've learned to trust my gut way more recently. And even though like it seems like so suboptimal, when you kind of know, you know, it's nice to eventually see them cast a spell that you're playing around and be like, oh, I knew it. But sometimes the game doesn't progress where they ever cast it and you never really know. But once you develop your Magic instincts and reading your opponents a bit better, it kind of tips the scales at a certain point where it's like your gut instinct and your feel of the game should become the thing that you follow the most versus just like if you zoom out and be like, well, there's a 30% chance they have this, so I should take the 70% chance line or whatever, right? I like heavily weight my gut feeling over out of context odds, if you will.
And then we come to tricks. Tricks are a bit easier to put people on because you can narrow them down pretty easily these days. You can know, okay, these are the tricks they could have. These are the tricks they're likely to have. Let's go with the common. You each have a bear play and they rumble in on turn 3. How much do you really value your bear? Are you just going to put it out there to let it die to a trick? Well, a lot of the times it's good to get that trick out of their hand. But let's say you have a dispersal in your hand that lets you wreck that trick, but you can't play it right now because you tapped out for your bear. You're more likely in that situation to take the damage and the next turn set up a block that draws the trick out so you can get them with dispersal. But if your circumstances are unlikely to change into something like that, then getting them to use mana and a card on your 2-drop is great when you're just going to play a 3-drop next turn that brick walls what they have out. I'm going to put this one out here again. I don't like engaging in combats that I'm not happy with the trades without using my trick, because I don't want to be the one that has to blink first.
Yeah. And conversely, if you're the one representing the trick and you attack and they don't block while they're tapped out, and then the next turn they have the same exact blocks presented to them and they happen to have a mana or two up and then they decide to make that exact same block, or they don't counterattack you and they just pass, and then this time they had blockers with mana up and the lack of a counterattack looks a little suspicious, that should be a clue to be like, oh, they're trying to 2-for-1 me here. I'm not going to attack into them. And that's how you like steal back some mana advantage, right? You strand their mana. Once they show they're wise to what you're doing and start to play around it, you can kind of make your decisions to then make them have to keep on playing around it, or else they're just going to kind of waste mana and whatever card they have stuck in hand.
Removal is another interesting one, because there are lots of ways to play around it in MOM, like Angelic Intervention, Cyber Cryptomancer, etc. It's really a calculated risk of how important to your game plan the piece you want to protect is, and whether or not you can actually afford to wait to hold something up.
I think a lot of this is, can you afford it, is kind of the main thread across all these scenarios and like playing around these different types of cards. You should always know, obviously, what your deck's trying to do, but you should get a good sense fairly early on what your opponent's main game plan is. Like, it's pretty obvious if they're coming out the gate hot with a Knights deck or like some like green-white counters deck, versus they're like, oh, they're setting up Sultai mana and all they've done is gone like turn 3 burgeoning, turn 4 bounce something.
Yeah, imagine how bad it is when you're setting up to go, okay, I'm gonna play this and have this thing to protect it, and those are your two cards in hand, and they're just like an Invasion of Eldraine.
Right. You should really kind of quickly in your head, consciously or subconsciously, develop your own game plan specifically for the match. And that should have kind of sub plans associated with it that revolve around how do you play around removal, counter spells. Can I afford to just like slow roll them? Probably not if you're an aggro to mid range deck and then you're playing against some grindy over the top deck. Like, you can't really afford to hold your 2 drops, 3 drops too long because you're just going to give them the time they need. The way of quote-unquote playing around removal would be just like dumping your hand, saturating the board, and overwhelming them to where their like 4-drop deadly derision isn't fast enough to stop you. The worst thing to do is kind of like toe the line, right? You either got to fully commit or you got to like play the long game and outsmart them and kind of play the attrition game and making them make bad trades and things like that. But you can't half-ass it.
Overall, you need to think of the likelihood that they have what you're playing around. Playing around something has a very real cost to it. Don't give up 10% of win percentage in that game playing around something they might have 2% of the time. It's a whole different scenario when you're playing the only way I can lose is this, or when you're just cold playing around a mythic, you have no indication that they have instead of trying to win.
Yeah, I think I fall on, I'm too conservative sometimes. Maybe this is pure pessimist versus an optimist, or if I've just been burned so many times by obscure things in the past that I'm like a wounded animal now. But I'm always like, they're going to have it. They have to have it. Surely they just top deck this card and it's their splash color, but I know it's this card.
Only you, man.
I have to do better about being a bit looser with assuming they have it. I should probably temper my assumptions that they always have the card that's going to wreck me a bit, because I think it actually hurts me on average in the long run.
Yeah, keeping track of what they've shown you really can help. Have they been holding up mana for a trick? Did your opponent randomly not attack with something that left them with a combination of blue-blue 4 and lands and creatures?
Right.
It's either a very good bluff or they're ready to artistic refusal you in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and you could really abuse like arena priority stuff with Convoke. It's kind of lame because it's like a little too obvious when there's like an aerial boost active.
Bet you that's like half a grade better in real life than it is on arena.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. I think that's why Nightmare is so good, because it's uncommon and it's like not top of mind so much. I always get wrecked by that card because I always kind of low-key forget about it's an option sometimes with random black creature up or two with one land. But I will say playing around things, I think we alluded to this earlier, is very important about reading your opponent and their game plan. For whatever reason, that's something that's one of the easier things that comes to me, and I think you're the same way. But I could see having to specifically work on it if it's something that you don't have experience doing so much in your Magic lifetime. And so it's always a good approach when you're kind of jiving with the set or you're doing well and you have a deck that's like so overpowered that you're like, oh, I'm pretty favored to win these matches out the gate. It's a nice little subject to maybe put on top of mind and be like, you know, I'm going to practice trying to predict what my opponents have based on how they're playing. And it's good to like hone the skill, not when you absolutely need the skill, you know? It's good to be working on it. So when it's really important to actually be able to leverage a skill, you could do that. You don't want to try a new type of jump shot while you're playing a playoff game, right?
Right.
It's kind of the same thing. When you have the opportunity to work on something, even though you don't even think you need that skill to necessarily win the match you're in, it's probably the best time to practice it. Something people can do if they want to try to improve without really risking their win percentage during the process. I think this is a good mini skill to develop.
As in with any skill, there's always that point where you're like, I've added this new ability, and then you have to integrate it. So your win percentage might actually go down for a little while you're trying to do it, because it's very important to know not to just play around everything. I've seen that as a huge mistake where some people are like, oh, I'm playing around this counter, I'm playing around that. When you have to accept that some things are going to die, there's going to be exchanges. You just have to realize what actually matters.
Josh said it earlier as a point at the end of a sentence, but I think it can be a standalone point of your two drops. Getting anything out of their hand is a good use of a two drop or one drop even. Trading for a two drop, trading for a removal spell, trading for a counter that's probably on rate or even better than rate for what your two drop's going to be doing anyway, unless it's like a spell sphere, right, that you can transform and just win the game with. Don't be afraid to use your resources in that way. If you turn your two drop into getting a counter out of their hand and you kind of were going to get got by that counter if you let them hold it, your two drop kind of acted as a counter to their counter in like a really roundabout way. But you shouldn't be afraid to run things out there or to make these trades for combat tricks, because they're going to get you later on, probably worse.
You don't want it to be blowing out a triple block.
Right.
I felt that was a good discussion and our new take of keeping everything short.
Yeah, I think it's good. I think it's digestible, actionable, and informative.
We still have cool play of the week, though.
Okay, yeah, let's hear it.
This one dropped right after I finished recording last week, or it probably would have come out ahead then, but it is our good buddy Sirkovitz dropping some heat. His opponent, Sunfalled, as one is known to do in this format. The response was to then cast Breach into a Tally and OG Elish Norn. A Tally hit Sunder to kill the Sunfall token and a random Cavalier. Quite a turn of events there from some opponent going, ha, I just Sunfalled somebody. Ha ha ha.
Oh boy, I got Sunfalled many times during the qualifier week. No bueno.
Now that's cool.
That was cool.
Except the part where you got Sunfalled a bunch of.
I mean, it was cool for someone.
Somebody had a good time. All right. Come check out our totally free Discord where you can get deck techs, pick advice, check out trophy decks, discuss limit, or just chill. You can find the Draft Lab on Twitch at, okay, let's be honest, I'm not streaming unless some major event happens. Floridamon, Equal TV, to Jordan, and DeFor. Don't forget to check out mtgazone.com for awesome strategy articles by the Draft Lab, and by that I mean me. Well, that's 83 episodes in, and somehow Chris hasn't punched me in the face yet.
Because we're not in the same room. It's not that much of a mystery.